And welcome to a PrivCap webinar. I'm David Snow, a partner at PrivCap Media. And today we've got a great topic for you. It's called Private Equity Challenge, Creating a Plan of Action from Operational Due Diligence. We have a great panel of experts who are going to share their insights with you today. And before we get started, I'm going to ask each of them to briefly introduce themselves.
I'm Susan Clark. I'm a managing director here at Sun Capital Partners. I've been part of the operating side of private equity for the last 8 years, as first at Vista Equity Partners, then at a firm called TCV, and now at Sun. Great to be here.
Steve Hilgendorf. I'm a co-lead our operations practice at Alex. And in that capacity, I support due diligence and operational turnaround work across a variety of industries. Probably more than 50% of my work is in the PE space, so very familiar with it. And my background is split. I spent the first half in the corporate world running various operational roles, running plants. And then second half, I've been doing that in the consulting world. So I bring that perspective as well, been on both sides of the table there.
Hi, everyone. I'm Nate Alexander, Managing Director in our private equity and investor practice. I'm also the local market leader for our Los Angeles office. I work almost exclusively with private equity clients, helping them to design and implement what we call sustainable value creation programs. The work we do typically spans the entire deal lifecycle, so from due diligence to pre-close planning to post-close value creation.
We're talking about operational due diligence in the course of private equity investing. What is operational due diligence?
Well, due diligence more broadly is all about validating a deal thesis. And so the work that you perform during a diligence really depends on the aspect of the thesis that's under examination. So for example, you've got commercial due diligences that tend to be a little bit more market focused, trying to understand competitive dynamics, you know, customer stickiness, et cetera. Really there, the funds are trying to answer the question, you know, do we want to be in this sector? And is this the right company for us to invest in, you know, given our own investment strategy? You also have financial due diligence. And that's a little bit more inward looking, and as the name suggests, focus on the asset's financials. So think quality of earnings, you know, audit controls, so forth and so on. And that's really around establishing a sort of clear understanding as to what the historical financial performance of the asset has been, because that's going to be the baseline against which you measure future performance. And then you have what I would broadly call the operational due diligence work. Here, the question that the fund is typically trying to answer is, you know, what is the go forward full value creation potential for that asset? And what are the potential risks associated with it in terms of capturing that value potential? So questions like, is there an opportunity to perhaps improve Salesforce effectiveness and efficiency? Is there opportunities to optimize the G&A function or how the procurement capability operates? All of these questions are part of what gets examined in the operational due diligence, and the output of which is a set of initiatives or value creation plans that the fund can then use as part of the underwriting process, as well as part of their, you know, first 100 days or first 12 month kind of planning once the transaction has closed.
Susan, as someone working at a major private equity firm, you know, what are you trying to accomplish in the course of operational due diligence?
Well, as Neto just suggested, it's really validating the investment thesis and drilling into the data available to validate and or disqualify those investment thesis criteria that we're looking at. It's also to evaluate the executive team and really understand the level of talent within the company, where there may be gaps, and, you know, essentially create a go-forward plan post-close. And once again, that go-forward plan is all based on some assumptions and some data and what we're able to see pre-close. But what we do here at Sun is post-close, we spend the next couple months really double-clicking and in some cases triple-clicking into those 3 to 5 areas that we think are areas of opportunity. For example, Salesforce effectiveness and really understanding, you know, what are the capabilities that are in-house What is validating whether or not, you know, the cross-sell, upsell opportunity is as suspected during diligence. And then ultimately, we've got a process within Sun called shared vision. And so we do all the operational due diligence. We close the transaction. We partner with the executive team, double click, triple click into how they're functioning. And then after about 3-4 months time, have a shared vision that in essence is the go forward value creation plan. And so the goal of operational due diligence is to be able to have that done quickly and to really have done homework so that we can accelerate that value creation plan as much as we can.
The other aspect is to bring in the operational assessment earlier in the process can really have some advantages, right? Because you can identify risks up front and there's potential to identify additional upside that may not be built in already. There's always going to be kind of sales growth and productivity and grand visions of what the potential is. You know, we're there to help identify risk, but also upside that they may not even realize. And part of that, whether it's assessing the management team and what their capabilities are and how much better things could be run, I think is also really important info, you know, early on in the process.
As private equity has developed, there's been a little bit of bifurcation between the deal partners and then the operating partners. The deal partners do the deal, hand the company gets acquired, and then the operational people flood in. And yet those lines are starting to blur a bit, right?
As far as who owns that function at the private equity firm, it really depends. You've got some firms like Vista, TCB, and now Sun that have folks like myself that take ownership in that process. We partner with the deal team and the deal lead. But in effect, you know, my job is to do that double clicking. And in most cases, I bring in outside folks that are experts in certain areas. For example, on tech due diligence, certainly I'm not, you know, I haven't coded for 25 years. So I bring in firms that are experts in that area to validate and highlight where there are areas of opportunity within the tech stack, within the software product that we're looking at, and ultimately help me understand how much tech debt there may be at a company. But by all means, you know, my job is to orchestrate that, being an operating partner in a firm. In some cases, firms that don't have folks in my role will offload that to very capable partners like Alex Partners and others to do that comprehensive study. And then, you know, ultimately, whomever does it, the intent would be, at least on my side, is whomever is identifying the opportunities within due diligence, it just facilitates an easy transition into post-acquisition value creation. So oftentimes, if I have a firm that does maybe some Salesforce effectiveness evaluation, it's very easy for me to then turn to them post-close. They've already done their homework and they can just jump in pretty immediately. But it, you know, it's one of those, it depends. And there's about as many flavors of it as there are PE firms.
Steve and Neto, your firm, Alex Partners, is involved in a ton of, you know, sale processes. Are you seeing, you know, Steve, you mentioned there being more and more reasons to really do early work, sort of heavy lifting that might not have been done, you know, 10 years ago at that stage is now being done. Does that provide a competitive advantage for the private equity firms that really dive in deep earlier than is typical?
My thoughts are, yeah, I think it actually, it really does. Because again, the quicker you can identify risks and again, Nato can probably speak to this better, but it seems like the timeframes are getting compressed. There's a ton of volume and transaction going out. I think trying to do things quicker and faster, I think it's really easy to overlook something. And I think getting people involved that can really dive deep quickly, faster, and uncover risks is really important.
So I think Steve's absolutely right. I mean, the pace of deal making, the time frame against which it's being executed, the fact that multiples are where they are today, the competition for these assets is pretty high. And so the value that funds get from having, experienced folks supporting them, whether that be in-house folks or partners, through early on through the operational due diligence process is they get to first quickly identify where perhaps there's value that others may not see, and certainly do so in a way that results in an actionable plan that can actually go after that value. Or conversely, they may get to understand where perhaps there's too much risk or the pricing perhaps does not warrant the value that they think is there. So there's tremendous benefit with respect to not just doing the operational due diligence, but engaging the operating partners and advisors early in the process so that you have the benefit of that perspective going into the final deal-making decisions.
The other thing I would add to that is oftentimes, at least at my current firm, we're looking at founder-led companies. And founders often too want to make sure they're handing over their baby to a firm and to someone that they can trust that will grow it. And so there are really a lot of benefits to forging those relationships, really coming to some agreement on the future state of that company in advance of acquisition. It can ultimately help a founder make a decision. If they've got two firms there or multiple firms they're contending with, if they feel trust and alignment with the overall value creation plan and the shared vision that the firm's ultimately going to want to achieve post close.
Yeah, it's a great point, Susan. I think the due diligence process is also that period where you're kind of getting to understand the culture of the asset that's being bought. You kind of understand how they make decisions, how quickly they move, what sort of makes the organization tick. And that's really important because, Susan talked about the shared vision at Sun Capital. It's very hard to execute on these things without an aligned management team. And so it's important early on in the process to use that due diligence period, not just to get some of the tactical things that we're talking about here. What's the value creation plan? Is there technical issues, et cetera, but also some of the softer things around, is this the right kind of culture? How will we work with these folks going forward to make sure that, you can capture the value that gets identified during diligence?
Yeah, and I've seen, not to be repetitive, but I have seen founders where, ultimately they make a call because they get excited about, okay, if I partner with this firm, they're going to help me grow my company in all these ways. And there's resources and there's a lot of benefits that we as operating partners within a firm can bring, well-vetted resources, once again, like Alex Partners and others that, they may not have those connections or just best practices that, as we often said at FISTA, are common sense, but not common practice, that can ultimately drive growth within a company.
I'd love to hear some stories about things that get uncovered, whether on the positive side or the negative side, by doing a bit more operational focused due diligence as early as possible. Steve, what comes to the top of mind as far as, things that you might learn that really impact the decision on whether or not to move forward with a deal?
Well, I'd say I'm always kind of looking on the delivery side of things, right? You're always going to have a really rosy picture of tremendous growth potential that the target is presenting. And I'm always trying to look at whether they can really deliver that, right? So from a capacity standpoint, is it real? Whether it's equipment or people, just because they have the equipment doesn't mean it's been maintained and it's actually capable. So we're really trying to deep dive whether this is real. There's going to be a huge CapEx check that's got to be written after the fact to really deliver the growth that you're looking for. And on the people side, they usually have some productivity assumptions built in. Sometimes it's pretty easy to scrutinize that, whether it's real or not. But I think there's also the upside, right? There could be huge productivity upside. I often find that the target doesn't realize because they think they're operating as best they can. So they have, they've had certain assumptions that they could be, but from a outside perspective, there could be tremendous potential to perform even better than they are assuming. And I think that's an important input as well. And of course, assessing the talent, like Susan, I think, alluded to already, is always a key thing we're taking a look at, because most of the times that's the management team is either going to help this thing get to the next level or they're not.
And I would say to add to that, there are kind of two categories I put all the diligence findings in. One are fixable things and one are not fixable things. Or maybe in fairness, accelerants that we can drive post-close. And so ultimately operational due diligence includes, and once again, I work in software and in tech. And so is the product built well? Is there a ton of tech debt that just would, kind of get in the way of progress or add, maybe M&A add-ons that we would have to deal with the tech debt versus, some of the growth accelerants. But, a lot of the other things, I love a company. I love to find a company that has an amazing product that customers love that no one knows about because, they don't have an effective marketing team, or perhaps that they just haven't expanded and don't have an effective sales force. And that's where we can really lean in. And it's all about growth in those two categories.
And just maybe to add to that, some of what I think both Steve and Susan mentioned sort of gets manifested as well in that in many cases, you will have a management team that puts forward in their SIM, a management plan or a somewhat, optimistic kind of view as to what they think the performance improvement potential might be. And a big part of the operational due diligence work is to validate that. So if the management team perhaps says, hey, we think that we can get, margin improvement of a certain quantum, or perhaps as Susan kind of mentioned, the strategy is based on perhaps reprioritizing the product portfolio. You've got to do that work to double click and understand, well, if we're going to do this reprioritization of portfolio, are we sitting on a lot of technical debt? Are we sitting on a lot of bugs and promised features that, if we were really even just trying to sunset or go into maintenance mode on this thing, it would require so much investment that, you'd be prevented from really putting your R&D dollars behind the parts of the product families that you really want to drive growth in the future. So a lot of what we tend to uncover is based on, as Susan described, things that certainly could accelerate if there's opportunity to unlock better value or improved value. But also where there might be, risks or potential watch outs in terms of what the management team might think the operations should look like in alignment with the strategy that's been put forward.
Susan, I like the way you framed findings from operational due diligence as either fixable or not fixable. On the fixable side, can we all talk about how to translate these findings into a plan of action? Into the underwriting process or into the 100-day plan or whatever kind of plan the private equity firm in question uses. Is there sort of a fluid conversation, Susan, between, due diligence and kind of the plan, the underwriting process, and kind of give us a sense of how that works?
There absolutely should be. And in best case scenarios, there is a conversation. And I think that's where ultimately, it's the pattern recognition. It's some of the baseline metrics on what we look at. As an operator within private equity, looking at tech, there's certain baseline metrics that I've seen repeatedly get realized in companies that we've invested in. And so, by implementing, for example, Salesforce effectiveness best practices, I know we can get cross-sell, upsell from, X to Y. And certainly there's conservatism built into that plan. We don't want to overstate it. And certainly post-close, we do that double-clicking and triple-clicking to make sure that in fact it can be met. But ultimately, the ideal goal would be for the deal team to collaborate with the operating partner or in other cases with the outside provider that they've hired, to validate and get additional credence and credibility behind those numbers. Ultimately, what happens at Sun and is that I go into investment committee alongside my deal partner, and it's not only yes, we all agree to what's being presented as far as the base case, but also I'm shaking my head saying yes, I'm signing up for what's required post close to get them there. And, ultimately, I think that's where that collaboration should be a part of the process from start to finish. and ultimately not pull me in when we're just evaluating companies, but there is a good point which needs to be agreed to by the operating partner and deal partner on, you know, this is the point in which it's worth your time to get involved and make sure that we've got your eyes on these things. So absolutely, it goes into play, not only pre-close and underwriting, but ultimately, you know, it's me signing up for all the work post-close.
And Susan mentioned pattern recognition, right? And that pattern recognition ability or experience becomes even more critical with the pace that these deals are moving at. And also given the fact that in many cases you're operating with not perfect information, right? So many times you're going to have to make a decision on what you think the value creation opportunity might look like without the perfect set of data, knowing that, you know, during pre-close planning and after the deal closes, you'll have opportunities to kind of refine that, maybe narrow the range down, sort of take that iterative process. So fully agree with everything Susan just said. I'd also go on to say that, you know, depending on the deal thesis, the findings that come out of an operational due diligence go into the deal model. So for example, as Steve mentioned, if you found that, you know, maybe there's going to be a need for CapEx investment, or perhaps you found, hey, maybe there's a $100 million EBITDA improvement opportunity. Those findings, whether it's the raw numbers or some adjusted view of those numbers from a conservative perspective, ultimately go into the deal model and influence the willingness to pay or how much the folks are willing to pay and how they think about the value creation story going forward.
Steve, as someone who has observed the interplay between the due diligence and, you know, anticipating a plan of action if the deal is won, do you have any observations or suggestions for, you know, when that goes well? Obviously, you know, Neto talked about how you don't always get perfect information. You're moving at light speed, but you still have to make decisions that impact how a plan might come together. So any thoughts around that?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, is obviously you want it to be as seamless as possible, right? So despite not having all the best information and often a very compressed time frame, right? We're trying to put together the most realistic value creation plan that we possibly can, and one that we'd be prepared to step in and start implementing immediately, right? So usually imprecision yields a little bit more conservatism, but either way, it ought to be something that you ought to be able to step up and immediately go put into action, I'd say, if you're doing things right. You guys agree with that?
Along those lines, I think not to be underestimated too is making sure that post-close, because there is imperfect information, because it is done at such an accelerated pace, we as operating partners or providers do need to take the time post-close, not just take that you know investment thesis and run with it, but certainly validate it. And there's homework to be done there. And that during that process, it's not only validating, but it's getting the executive buy-in to what needs to be done so that ultimately they have ownership in that execution. And it's not the PE firm or the outside provider pushing them on things that, you know, ultimately they're not bought into.
How do you deal with a management team if there's a little bit of pushback on pacing, on speed, on sort of the urgency of the value creation, either in plan form or in execution form? Is that a culture clash that sometimes emerges, and how do you deal with that?
Yes, there's often that case, and they're always, I'd say we're always willing to go faster than they are in general. And there's so that's a natural tension. I think working very closely from my position, partnering with the PE firm to get the management team oriented in the right direction and calibrated to the right pace. And as we alluded to before, there may be a need to maybe change out if ultimately we can't get there. But this is all about getting buy-in, and there's change management here, right? So all the normal skill sets to get anybody aligned on a goal and motivated down that path, I think, apply here.
You know, all the more reason why it's important early on in the process to kind of get an understanding of the culture and an understanding of how they make decisions, et cetera. Because, you know, changing a management team is difficult. Changing anyone on a management team is disruptive. It takes time. I mean, these searches can go for months. And you'd love to avoid that if you can. And so in many cases, I've seen private equity firms do a great job of perhaps partnering or bringing additional resources and showing how things could be done differently, given the number of companies in their own portfolio, whether that's pairing up members of the management team with other portfolio company executives or external support to help them understand why the art of the possible is possible. There are a lot of probably tactics like that that we've seen successfully kind of bring folks along. But as Steve and I think Susan alluded to earlier, a big part of this is change management. And so it's a little bit of winning hearts and minds, but also certainly driving forward and making sure that you can capture the value that you sort of set out to in your deal model.
I couldn't agree more. And a couple more just points to add here. Number one is oftentimes, we come into an executive team and they're like, okay, we all have full-time jobs here. And what you just added was adds to our existing like set of things that we're doing. So sometimes it takes a bit of, okay, what are we going to stop doing? In addition to that, it's also with every company that I work on, I add someone in that chief of staff role, kind of chief transformational officer, director of strategic programs. You can label it however you want, but in essence, an individual to own the value creation plan. Sometimes it's someone within the company that they can elevate to that role. In other cases, we may need to bring someone from the outside, but ultimately it's someone that CEO and executive team can look to orchestrate and really own this value creation plan execution. Now, certainly they all have functional ownership and the CEO has ultimate ownership, but it's kind of surfacing those sorts of opportunities. And then in some cases, if there are execs that still are dragging their feet or not really jumping in or not understanding the pace at which private equity works, you need to have that hard conversation with them. Maybe this isn't the role for them. And let's figure out a way to transition them out. I think also connecting them to other companies that have gone through that, been there, done that, they can, either complain about us or together and commiserate, or, provide some helpful hints on how to get through that transformational process.
Susan made a really, really good point, and one we should probably talk about for a quick second. Susan described it as the chief of staff role, but if you think about how this process works, you're going to go through this diligence period. You're going to have the outlines of a value creation plan. You're going to, validate a lot of that during pre-close and the early stages post-close. But you're going to end up with a plan that says, hey, here are the six or seven big initiatives that, will drive value creation here. And maybe there's a tail of other initiatives. And many times those initiatives will be cross-functional. They will be enterprise-wide in many respects if they're going to drive significant value. And so there does need to be a culture of program governance, or at least the establishment of some amount of program governance, whether that's a chief of staff role or a transformation office or a PMO role, however you want to think of that. There does need to be that investment, because I think to Susan's point, everybody's got a day job, everybody's got work to do. And so it's important to make that investment so that you can get those value creation ideas and initiatives prioritized, because that's really what's now on the CEO's agenda, in addition to all the other things that was already on that agenda before the deal closed.
And I'd say prioritization is key. You're always going to have more stuff you want to do than you can do it at any one time. So you're always, that should be going after the biggest, be thoughtful about the priorities and so you get the quickest payback.
Now, Susan, you spent most of your career in tech and software deals. Can you talk about, are there any sort of automated or semi-automated steps that you take that are just part of the due diligence process and that are, quite programmatic? I don't think you necessarily have to list any specific products or software, services that you use, but just can you just give a quick synopsis of that part of due diligence for specifically for technology companies?
Two providers that I pull into every deal. One is a tech diligence provider. And for obvious reasons, they look at, cybersecurity, strength of the tech organization, ultimate solidification of like how well that product's developed. So that's one. And then the second being, I have a provider that actually looks at the code and down to the coding level of quality And we actually can see, you know, per developer, how effective the code is, where there's some problematic areas, if any. And those two, and actually these two providers complemented each other and work very collaboratively together to give me a full view on overall product quality, overall tech, cybersecurity, data quality, data, all that good governance, and then down at the code level. And that's the really make or break it evaluation, where if that comes back negative, or there's too much tech debt, or you know the whole organization is just not coding as effectively as possible, those are the things that you know I don't take lightly in regard to yay or nay. I would say the other sorts of things programmatic that we do, certainly looking at and doing an evaluation of the executive team. And that isn't specific to tech by any means, but you know, I think it's the bigger the strength or the better the executive team and the more ready they are, back to our last question and commentary on it, the more ready they are for this sort of transformational opportunity, then the better off we all are. And so I programmatically look at those two. And then of course, you know, go to market, Salesforce effectiveness, because that oftentimes is an area of opportunity. And then customer feedback, and oftentimes the deal team does customer calls and that sort of thing, but how are they serving their customers? How are they ensuring that, you know, customer success is paramount to the process? You know, what does that customer journey look like? Oftentimes I can't get into the weeds in that particular area as much as I'd like to, but that's kind of the order of importance that where I evaluate.
We have a question here about, connected to what Susan was just talking about using KPI benchmarks that allow you to compare rapidly, you know, the company you're looking at versus other companies in the same sector. Steve, to what extent are those used in the pre-deal stage?
Because I think that's it's a slippery slope. So I think you can be really, really careful using benchmarks, and everybody asks for benchmarks because they love to see where they stand against others. You have to be very thoughtful in how you apply them though, because they're never perfect. There are always differences, even within the same industry, in my opinion, and making similar products. Everyone could have a reason for something to be different. And maybe that's their advantage. Like they're doing more, trying to be more responsive to the market, and they have more customer service or whatever. So we use it to identify areas that are out of line and potential opportunities or risks, but then always do the deep dive underneath that, trying to understand what's driving that, to whether it's, you know, it's justified, or if it's truly an opportunity for to make an adjustment, right, to trim things out or whatever. I don't know if you guys comment, if you disagree with that, but I think they're useful to point you in a direction, but I would never be very concerned about drawing too much conclusions just based on a benchmark.
Yeah, so benchmarks are a helpful starting point, but as Steve sort of described, you need to kind of triangulate, right? So, you know, benchmarks might lead you to a top-down perspective or assessment that says, hey, we think X to Y is achievable. But then you really need that bottoms-up validation, and perhaps in some cases, thinking through what's the clean sheet, you know, zero-based, opportunity suggests. And if you think about some of what Susan mentioned earlier, whatever you're coming up with needs to, at the end of the day, be actionable and implementable, right? And it's very difficult to sort of just have a value creation plan that's simply based on the notion that, you know, our G&A expense as a percent of revenue is a couple points higher, and therefore, you know, without understanding why that might be the case, or understanding, you know, what might need to happen to fix that, it's very difficult to sort of put a lot of credence in that kind of a finding.
One additional thing to add, there's no greater way of just getting, of really upsetting your exec team than to say, well, the benchmark says we're supposed to do this. Because ultimately you need to get to know their business. And you know, I think it just leads to credence in what we're all partnering to go do by putting that lens of the company's business on those KPIs.
just to give a super simple manufacturing example, right? You can look at exact same products on two companies making the same thing. One could be a little more automated. There, you could start benchmarking in their headcount, and indirect and indirect could be totally different, but they could have, that doesn't tell you whether one is more efficient or cost effective, right? You got to get underneath that.
Neto and Steve, since you both observe how private equity firms, you know, resource themselves for all these deals that they do, and your own organization probably has this need as well, which is, how do you institutionalize the knowledge that you learn from each deal, from all the findings? Is there a playbook that is created so that the next time you come across a similar finding, there's a broadly shared set of responses? I don't know, Neto, what you guys do?
Yeah, I think certainly you want to leverage the learnings from past diligences, but some of that kind of depends on the fund and the fund's strategy, right? There are some funds that are very diverse. I look at assets in a lot of different areas, and yes, they may have deal teams, but that sort of diversity in terms of the kinds of targets they go after does limit the extent to which you can continue to leverage all the things that you might have learned in previous deals. Other funds that are very focused on specific sectors, I think you tend to see a lot more of what you're describing in terms of, hey, we kind of know what the playbook looks like. We have a good sense for the sector. We have a good sense for the players in the sector. And we know what's worked in some of the other companies, perhaps that we've done work with there. And so it sort of depends on the operating model, if you will, and the strategy for the fund itself. But certainly I think everyone, given the pace at which we're moving at, are looking for opportunities to leverage past experiences and make sure that we kind of codify the learnings, because that really informs and helps you be better at the decision-making that's required to close good deals.
I just had a comment. I think I don't want to ever characterize that we would take a kind of a recipe or a playbook, right? I think that's a little risky to get assume you could just do it the same way every time. You always kind of get down to the fundamentals of operational performance and financial performance to really, because every situation is different. I think obviously seeing it more times and repetition allows you to do things faster and scrutinize things quicker, and you get a sense for where to dig deep, but you really got to get down to the fundamentals, I think, to really uncover true value creation.
The one thing I'd add is I like the term toolkit versus playbook. Playbook insinuates that it's something you do every time at the same way, but toolkit, I've got a bunch of tools that I've come to learn over the last 8 years. And ultimately, those are tools that are very rinse and repeat. And I know the best provide, for example, pricing. Pricing is something I look at for every company, because ultimately what I found in tech is every company has opportunity to improve their pricing. I've got a particular provider that is my go-to. And so I've got that like rinse and repeat model with that provider. And then with the deal team, they understand, you know, kind of how this works. And so ultimately we all want to move fast and there's only one of me. And so ultimately by having that as a repeatable process, and I've got that in certain areas that just, you know, are those that are very common. And then there's always nuances that, you know, particular companies require that are supplemental to those tools.
Susan, is travel still necessary, or can you get ODD done over a Zoom call? I know I asked this because you told us in our pregame meeting that you have been traveling quite a bit. And so is that worth it?
So during the heart of COVID, I did not travel into diligence remotely. It's not ideal. There's no greater, you know, opportunity than to get in front of a person and have that face to face. But we improvised, and you know, I think it is doable. But my preference would be face to face.
I would say I stopped for a few months, but we were pretty much back at it after a few months into the pandemic in the middle of 2020. Just because in the manufacturing world, especially, we got really creative. We did do very effective things remotely, video camera and such, but ultimately we ended up getting back on site. And today it's a bit of a hybrid, right? We still do most of our work remotely just because that's preference for everybody, and actually is cheaper, saves travel expense. But we're still almost always doing a site visit when there's some kind of manufacturing operation involved.
I think both Susan and Steve are right. I think the pandemic sort of showed that, you know, certainly the industry and the service providers in here can be very resilient, especially in the tech space. I think when things slowed down in Q2 2020 and then they started picking back up afterwards, you know, the pace of deal making didn't slow down. So we found ways in which to execute deals and support clients through that process remotely. But certainly, you know, this is a people business, and it's a lot easier to build those relationships, to understand that culture, to do all of the things that we talked about previously, if you can sit across the table from the person next to you. That said, I think Steve's point that we're probably not going to go back fully to where we were in the past. I think that's just the reality of where we are right now. We'll probably end up somewhere in the middle. I think it you know, remains to be seen exactly what that reality will be for us going forward.
Well, this sounds like relatively good news for the business travel market. So we'll leave that on a high note, at least for that industry. And once again, a huge thank you to Steve Hilgendorf and Neto Alexander, both from Alex Partners, and Susan Clark from Sun Capital Partners. We hope to have you back on a PrivCap program in the future.